Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email, ogc@accessradio.biz, biz is spelled B-I-Z, and you can use this address as we're to start a mailing list, which will then keep you informed of all the upcoming episodes and lots more. The address again is ogc@accessradio.biz. So please enjoy today's guest, who is an author, screenwriter, pastor and family man based in Michigan, USA. He has a passion for ministry to men of all ages, using trips to retreats and pilgrimages. He also is aware of how the local church needs to be constantly evaluated so that it doesn't become disjointed and remains true to God's plans. He calls himself an Anglophile of the highest order. I'll put him to the test in a few minutes' time on that one. So what is the book, The Last Lone Wolf, Recovering the Lost Sacrament of Friendship, about? And why did he write it? How do you write a screenplay and then get it to the big screen? What research did he have to do for his film Dinosaur Cove? What is the warrior's path? Why does he love the outdoors? And how can this free venue be used in ministry? What does he want to see happen in the local church? And finally, why is he an Anglophile? All these questions, time to get some answers, especially if the dog stops barking in the background. It gives me great pleasure to welcome to OGC, Derek Steele. Derek, thank you so much for joining us. What kind of dog is it?
We've got two dogs back there. One is a mix of a Chihuahua and an Australian Shepherd. So it's a teeny little Australian Shepherd. The loud one is the grandpa of the family. He's about 14 years old, and he is a mix. We've had him so long, I've forgotten what kind of mix he is, but he's a lap dog. He's very annoying, as you can tell. And so I tried to send my family out of the house for an hour because we have little ones that run around and scream like crazy. But the payoff of that is now I have no one to shut this dog up.
No, it's
so
quite all right.
I apologize.
We've had dogs in the background before. And it's interesting you say Australian Shepherd. I have no idea what an Australian Shepherd dog looks like. I know what a Belgian Shepherd and a German Shepherd are, but what's an Australian Shepherd dog?
Okay. They've got a bit of a lassie look. They've got the long nose. They're incredibly intelligent. They're beautiful. They usually have black and white coloring with some brown spots like over their eyes. And
okay.
I primarily wanted one because they're supposed to be super intelligent. And the last dog I had before I got married was a husky, which was absolutely beautiful and incredibly dumb. And the thing would run away and not know its way home. And I'd find it at the pound and have to pay to get it back out of the pound. And we just decided we wanted a dog that was smarter than that.
Yeah, so intelligent. You could teach the kids physics when you weren't in the room.
I have seen people on Instagram that do amazing things with these dogs, but we have not done that yet.
Not yet.
So, not yet. Okay.
Before we start the five questions, I'm very interested in the fact you call yourself an Anglophile, and we'll know more about later on. But let's just see how much of an Anglophile you are. So here we go.
Oh, boy.
Apart from diesel, what is the main fuel used in the majority of cars called?
Petrol.
Very good. You do. You're very good. Here's the second one. The classic E-type car named after a large spotted cat is called what? Car manufacturer from Britain. Makes the classic E-type.
Jaguar?
No, it's Jaguar. Sorry.
A Jaguar. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. I do have an American accent.
You see,
so.
This is it. You see, I thought I'd catch him out on one.
Jaguar.
It's a Jaguar. And there's no such thing as aluminum. It's an aluminium.
I do love that. Yeah. I try to get all my flower names from watching Monty Don. Gardener's World.
Oh, he's over in America, is he?
Yes.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
We can get him. Love it.
We've exported to you guys not only Jeremy Clarkson, but also Monty Don as well. Oh, that's brilliant. Well, let's go for it, good sir. That's all right. Five.
Absolutely.
Maybe not so important questions, or maybe they are. Mm-hmm. Let's see how you get on. Mm-hmm. Question number one. Derek, if you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask him questions, who would it be?
Well, I have no question that I would spend, if I had one evening, I would spend it with C.S. Lewis. I probably wouldn't want to invite him here for dinner. I'd rather go to Oxford, and perhaps even the dinner we picked would have the rest of the Inklings involved.
Oh.
So I could sit back and be a fly on the wall, watch Tolkien bring out The Hobbit chapter by chapter, reading it to the other guys as he's working his way through the writing of it, and listening to them give him opinions, edits, you know. The Inklings were together, I would get two for the price of one.
You would.
By having dinner with Jack Lewis, as his friends always called him Jack.
Yes.
He's such a character, not just the writing, but he's such a large Johnsonian, would you say, style character. He was somebody who was laughed long and loud and
yes.
and was incredibly intelligent. And I just feel like one evening with him, I'm not sure exactly the questions I would want to ask. I would simply want to be in his presence and watch him go to work.
Yeah, I love the idea of everybody being in the room like that. Of course, you'd have to go to the Eagle and Child pub.
Yes, or as they called it, the Bird and Baby, correct.
Is that what they called
it? Yeah, that was the slang for it.
Oh, was it the Bird and Baby? That's brilliant. Yeah. Apparently, it's hoping to reopen soon. It was closed after COVID, so I'm hoping it's going to be open soon because that's one of my pubs I'd like to go to as well and have a look.
Oh, yeah. I've only spent like 4 hours one afternoon in Oxford. That's it.
Did you get the chance to go to the pub?
No. Or
walk,
you know,
past it.
I got the chance to go to his college. Went to Magdalen College and saw, you know, his rooms and where he taught and things like that.
Well, if you do ever go over, you have to pop over to Northern Ireland where I live now, because of course C.S. Lewis, or Clive Staples as we call him, he's from here. So loads of places that got his imprint on. Thank you. Good answer, C.S. Lewis. Any particular question you would really like to ask him? Really, really ask him. No one's been able to yet.
Well, I'd rather ask him this now that he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
But yes. You know, his Narnia opens so many doors in my imagination, especially, you know, his rendering of the last battle and his picture of eternity. And you could tell he had a longing. He was quoted somewhere to say, you know, if I find in myself longings that nothing in this world can satisfy, then it seems to suggest that I was made for a different world. And his creation of Narnia was, you know, so heavenly. And I guess my question, and the burning question, and it is, this isn't just for fun. This is something I wrestle, you know, the burning question is, you know, Jack, Lewis, Jack, is it anything like you hoped it would be? Is the picture you gave us something I should be clinging to? Because I do cling to some of the beauty of the things he wrote and the magic and joy, the childish joy of the heaven that he described.
That's a great answer.
So that would be my question.
And of course, if you could have your time over again, when you said the book opened so many doors, what you could have said was the book opened so many wardrobe doors.
That is true. We had a wardrobe at my college that they claimed was the wardrobe.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. We have probably the biggest collection. I went to a place called Wheaton College near Chicago. And we have one of the biggest collections, probably the biggest collection outside of the Bodleian Library, of Lewis lore and papers, original stuff from his family. Because there were some people there collecting, you know, in the early 60s, 70s, immediately after his death, that were huge collectors of his stuff. And so it's really, really fun. But yeah, there's a wardrobe there. It's not magic. I've tried it.
Question two. Who is your favorite biblical character, Derek, or favorite biblical story, or favorite parable?
To go straight to the heart and be so important to my life, I have to say the parable of the prodigal son, because almost my entire worldview, my structure of understanding who God is, would take such a big hit. Let's say to take that parable away, to say it had never been spoken or it's extra biblical, we looked at it and it's not something Jesus said, it's not valid, I would realize so much of the structure of who I've built the Father to be would take a hit. And then I realized, well, I must have really placed a lot of emphasis on trusting that this story is giving me a valid picture of who he is.
Yes.
So the open arms, the waiting, that kindness, that awareness, that hunger to be reunited with his son. I just assume that this is who the Father is in the Christian worldview. And I realized that without that parable, a lot of that might be missing.
Great answer. So, thank you.
Yeah.
And of course, the other question that normally comes with that when someone chooses the prodigal son is, who was the most disappointed to see the son return?
Well, unless that's a trick question, I'd say it's his older brother.
A trick question from me?
Yeah, yeah. I've only been on about 15 minutes, and I know those are coming. So, so who was most disappointed?
Well, you're right. It was a trick question. So the fatted calf. That's the answer.
Yeah.
Question three. If you were Prime Minister of the UK, or if you were President of the USA, you can choose for the day. I could change any law or impose a new law. Derek, what would it be? Or President Derek?
Derek. Well, as my best friend did point out earlier today, of course, the president doesn't have the power to make a new law. So I would have to put something through Congress. And okay,
yes.
So if I magically also had a genie that now gave me the power to create a law, I think what I would create, I would say one day per month, it was utterly illegal to be seen in public with your cell phone.
Oh, you're not the first. Keep going.
Once every 30 days, it would be against the law, and everybody would have to figure out how life in the real world actually works without a screen to stare at. And people might meet each other, you know, on the train. I don't know what might happen.
Well, you're going to get that through because the gentleman I interviewed only last week did something very similar, but said once a week. So I think you've got more chance of getting yours through than the other chap who wants it once a week.
Yeah,
once a month is good.
Once a month, one out of 30. Yeah, no, I mean, yeah.
I actually lived throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s before Microsoft, Google, everybody else came along with their own phones.
Yeah.
You know, I survived.
And so many good old movies where the whole plot would have been ruined if they could have picked up a cell phone and warned somebody, right?
Exactly. And could you imagine the film The Phone Booth? Have you ever seen that? That wouldn't have existed.
That wouldn't have been. What would Superman have done? Where would he have changed? You know.
Well, there you go, you see. That's a very good point. Where would he have gone?
Yeah. It's a big deal with our ministry because we work with young guys, young adults.
Yes.
And it's not just funny. I mean, it's sad. It really is. We try to get them away for a weekend, you know, and leave the phones behind for a weekend. And you see that they're going through, you know, the DTs. I mean, they're having withdrawal symptoms. It's shocking. I've got a group of guys that come over to my house maybe once a week for pizza and discussion. Guys in their 30s, guys who should know better. And they will be scrolling through whatever. I don't know, even Instagram. I don't know what's their favorite pill, but they'll be scrolling at the table while we're trying to have a conversation. The thing won't go down for 2 hours. So yeah, I would make it illegal.
Very good.
That'd be fun to see. Obviously, other people had that same idea. So
if you do get your law through Congress, can you make sure that it can't be on a Saturday?
On a Saturday.
You are allowed your mobile phones on Saturdays.
On Saturdays. Yeah, I could pick a different day. Maybe Sunday. Sunday would be good, right?
Sunday would be a good one.
Sunday would be good.
Sunday would be good.
A Sabbath from the phone, you know.
And Saturday's obviously because we need to know how the football results are going on. Being purely selfish. Question four.
Yeah.
Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out, please, good sir?
I wasn't sure if by day out you meant I had to be within a traveling distance from my own home to get back again as a single day out.
Oh, very good.
That would probably limit because I was clearly going to say in the summer of 98, my best friend and I had a 5-day train pass leaving from London. And the experience, the first day we went as far as Swansea. The second day, though, was the day that we spent in Oxford. And that was probably either that or that evening that we spent in Glenfinnan. We were big Highlander fans, TV show, 80s, 90s. And we absolutely had to see the statue of the Highlander there in Glenfinnan. And it was one of those magical moments where we saw it on the map at the last minute. And we saw the train was stopping there. And we had no idea if there were hotels or anything there. And it was getting on towards evening. And we hopped off and we're like, we're going to figure this out. But it was a little scary and fun at the same time. And it was just, you know, a great time.
Don't keep us in suspense. Did you find it, first of all?
We did find it. And everyone probably who's ever watched a Harry Potter film knows the bridge.
Yes.
It's famous, you know, and that's right as you come past that corner.
Oh, is it?
It's either before or after the station, but yeah. But we got out. We were in the middle of nowhere. There is one great house down by the edge of the lock, and they have rooms, just a few. But there's a restaurant, pub inside, and a few rooms. And luckily, one of them was available for the night. So we were able to hike over to around the edge of the lock to the famous statue. I think we were about 28 at the time, and so we were still photogenic. And those were our photo days, which again, in technology today, nobody knows the joy of getting a roll of film and having absolutely no idea until you get it developed whether any of them are any good or not.
Mm.
But we had a ton of fun with a Canon, you know, with a zoom lens and pretending like we were somebody important. Yeah, just a gorgeous, gorgeous, incredible event for an Anglophile coming from our country and being there. And if it wasn't for what we called the biting gnats of Glenfinnan,
yes,
we might have had a much better time.
I can believe that. The midges.
Yeah, they chased us away.
Great answer. And of course, I remember watching the film Highlander. Sean Connery was in that, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yeah.
Yeah. Can I just say, I was bored stiff. But anyway, I couldn't get into it at all. So I have no understanding at all what this statue's all about, but I will check it out later on.
Okay.
That's a cracking answer.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm pretty sure it's Bonnie Prince Charlie is my guess, is the statue itself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know, that well-known Italian, because he was born in Rome, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Bonnie Prince Charlie, I think.
Snuck back and tried to start something.
He did. Let's move on. Question 5. What has been your most embarrassing moment, please, to date?
You know, I really struggled with that one. I have a lot of humiliating moments.
Oh.
Embarrassing moment. Just a few months ago, my family went on vacation. Once a year, we go down to Florida because mm-hmm. it can be cold here in Michigan. We were staying at a very, for us, a very posh place in Orlando. And we're super excited about it. Had been there a couple times. And we got down there and they asked me to run my credit card for incidentals. We had already paid for the 4 days we were going to be there. And you know that moment where you're just assuming everything is fine and suddenly somebody's staring at you and saying, I'm sorry, it's not working. You're like, there's something wrong with your card. So I asked my wife for the other, you know, debit card, because these are debit cards. And it didn't accept that one. We're standing here at this nice desk, checking into this nice hotel, 1,000 miles away from home. And I call my bank and we have overdrafted both of our bank accounts. We had zero money.
What?
We had zero money. I had about $300 in my pocket. My 15-year-old son, when he heard, said actually he was carrying $300 of his own that he had earned over the course of the year. So in a sense, it was embarrassing. In a sense, it was also like a little traumatic because we were a long way from home without money. And there were some tears shed. Those were by my wife, I will pretend. And we solved it. It was taken care of. Thankfully, in today's world, you can get transfers pretty quick. And, you know, we do have a couple of family members that still love us. You had to get it sorted. I'm not the greatest with money. I had recently let a friend borrow a very big chunk for his business and didn't realize how much that was going to deplete what I had available.
Yes.
If you could look back on it and laugh, it's pretty embarrassing to be standing at the desk of this nice hotel and be like, they're just looking at you like, you guys are the Beverly Hillbillies. You have zero money.
Wow. I thought when you started, this is going to go one of two ways. It's either going to be that somebody had emptied your bank account without you knowing, or you didn't have any credit cards on you and your son suddenly said, oh, you can use my credit card deck because it's on my mobile phone. Oh, wait a minute. Can't use it because it's a Sunday. I thought that's how it was going to go.
No, someone did empty my bank account without me knowing it, but that's just because I'm that absent-minded. So it was me.
Well, let's hope you can get the money back from your good friend you lent the money to in the first place.
Oh, I hope so. That was not a good choice. I was trying to be a good friend, but not wise.
Yes, thank you. Lots of people can identify with that, no doubt, listening today.
Yeah.
Great. I'm looking forward to today's podcast. This is going to be good fun. Michigan's a big state. Yes. Whereabouts are you in Michigan?
We are in the suburbs of Detroit, where most of the population in Michigan is – around just a couple of cities, and Detroit is the largest, but we're not city people, so it's probably a 25-minute drive to be downtown, and we probably go downtown once a year. We're mostly suburban people who wish we were rural people most of the time.
Well, Detroit obviously is very important to me with regard to music, because the best band to ever come out of America came from Detroit.
That's true. They have some real fame there before I was born, yeah. Thankfully.
Hopefully we're talking about the same band here.
I was giving the benefit of the doubt that there's been more than one band come out of here.
Yeah, there has. Yeah. You got Motown as well.
I'm not even going to take a shot at which band you're referring to.
Have a guess.
Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band.
No.
That was a guess, because I did like Bob Seger.
I'll put you out of your misery, shall I?
Yeah, go for it.
Aerosmith.
I can see somebody choosing Aerosmith. That's good.
So, sir, before we get into the nitty-gritty, why are you such an Anglophile?
I suppose because I'm such a romantic in general. Our history is so short here in comparison to the breadth and depth of European history. And obviously, to be a romantic, you need to get out of what is familiar. So, you know, that's people made science fiction because they wanted to pick a place that they didn't know. At one point in history, people made Arthurian stories because they were writing in France and imagined that England, you know, was the unknown realm that they could populate with, you know, mythical creatures. And so I don't know how much of that it is, that just the desire for something that is not familiar, how much of it is spiritual, simply with roots I don't even understand. My family, on both my parents' side, has been in this country from before the start of the 1700s. So even before the Revolutionary War, a long time, but the roots do go back. You know, you can find where they left from Wales, you know, left from one of the southern ports in England. So
is that why you went to Swansea then on the first day of your train pass?
Honestly, it was because we wanted to hit something in Wales and we were so ignorant as to what was there. We took the train that was headed that way and it paid off. It was gorgeous.
Yeah, Swansea's great.
But looking back, there's so much. I could probably spend a week's holiday in Wales alone, learning and exploring and experiencing. So, you know, I was a big fan of Peter Pan growing up, and obviously, you know, Peter Pan, London, they're very connected. Yeah. William Shakespeare, you know, the poet. As a teenager, I didn't like poetry or Shakespeare's plays. But so trying to be an author, obviously you change who your heroes are. And I look back and absolutely mesmerized with what he did, you know, in that Elizabethan time. I don't know. 1,000 reasons. We love gardening. And I don't know if we love gardening because we're Anglophiles or we're Anglophiles because we love gardening and so do they. I don't know which came first. I've played only one sport my entire life, and that is your football.
Oh, well said. I don't know what soccer is at all. I only know it's football.
It's hard. It's hard. I find myself saying soccer when I'm around these people, but then I feel like I need to, you know, go clean my mouth. It's 1,000 things. I do feel like London is, in my mind, the center of civilization. And obviously when you're there, there's also a lot of people who just have to go to work, and it's drudgery. And, you know, I see people who think going to LA, you know, Los Angeles would be incredible if they're from Europe. And I'm like, you know, my parents live an hour south of LA and it's not really a big deal.
I am fascinated to find out that you've written a screenplay, but not only that, you were able to get on the big screen as well. And it was a film called Dinosaur Cove. So how did that come about, please, Derek?
Okay, so unfortunately, as everything else in life, it has so much has to do with who you know.
Yes.
There are 10,000 more skilled screenplay writers around my country breaking their hearts to get something on the screen.
Mm.
I have a drawer full of, I think there's probably 5 or 6 complete screenplays that I wrote in my 20s.
Oh, wow.
And it was purely a romantic endeavor. I was living in the Detroit area, as far away from Hollywood as you could be, with no connections. And I wrote because I had this passion to write. I would even sometimes wait till late at night and light some candles just so I could get that Shakespearean vibe and enjoy some romantic feeling while I was doing it. But so this story is, I have a group of friends that I have dubbed the League of Stories, and they're actors and producers in the Christian film market, or at least when I met them, that was all they had done. They sort of came to me through my young adult ministry that I was doing at the time, and they were still in their late 20s at the time. I've known these guys probably for 6 or 7 years now. And we sit around the table and throw ideas out. And usually they get shot down. Usually I would draft 10 pages of something that cost me a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And then it would get thrown out. And what happened one day was my friend Daniel, who has his own small little film company, came and he said, I've got this idea. And it was Dinosaur Cove. It was an idea for a family kids focused movie. He had a few bullet points of where he envisioned the story going. I just took it. And it was kind of an incredible thing because I'm a slow writer. But over the course of about 2 months, we hammered out this entire thing. I would write 10 pages. They would come over and I would read them out loud. For the most part, with a few moments where they had to draw me back because there's no way they were going to have the budget to do what I wanted to do, I was able to hammer this thing out. I should be more fair. There were many moments where I had a better idea and I had to throw it away because of budget constraints, because this was going to be a small budget film.
Yeah.
Two of the guys at the table were acting in it. I was writing the parts, knowing their personalities. And the other guy had the production company. He was the director of photography. He was the director. He was going to film it. I knew as I was doing it that there was a strong possibility that this was going to be made. And it happened. It happened within about 4 months of me writing it. They had shot it. And then there was a good year and a half process of, you know, post-production stuff because they were doing it themselves. It's not going to rock the world.
Well, the actor's got an award though, didn't he?
He did, indeed. We were in for about 5 awards. I was in for award for the screenplay. Yeah, it was noticed. And I had an absolute blast. I mean, working with your friends, doing it with the heart of knowing I was going to probably earn nothing from it, but
yes,
it might be a vehicle for their careers.
Well, exactly.
They have done more things than they were doing prior to that. Little bits here and there. They continue to grow in their acting. I think all of them have seen advances in their careers since Dinosaur Cove. I have not, simply because it was primarily a recreation. It was off mission from a ministry perspective, you know, from where I would first choose to spend my time.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't turn anyone down who came to me and said, you know, we need you to write something, as long as what they were talking about was entertaining.
No, it's fantastic you've been able to do that because, hey, your name is on IMDb now.
That's
you know,
true.
That's the source for everybody, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just have a look.
Yeah.
And it's great. But there was one reference on there and it absolutely dissed the film. It was awful.
Oh my goodness.
I looked at it and read it all through.
Yeah.
What really annoyed me was I'm pretty sure that person did not even see the film, because then if you then click on the arrow to see all the other stories that people have written about the film, they're brilliant.
Yeah.
They really are good. So you got loads of good feedback.
So my friend Daniel has a film stalker. He's done about 8 different Christian films with his Crystal Creek Media, his company. And apparently this guy deliberately does everything he can. He's got several different accounts that he can use so he can leave more than one negative review. And he just tears him apart every single time.
That's him then.
I won't even read those. You know, I don't need to.
Well, ignore it, because all the other reports were very, very good.
I mean, it, like I said, it was simple because, you know, budget constraints had to make it simple. But I felt like my main task, what was the huge challenge, was that was the first time in my life that somebody had come to me and said, I have a plot. And now how can you make it come alive and make it interesting? And so it was a bigger challenge than usual. And I really enjoyed it because it could have gone other directions. You know, every time I wrote any sort of repartee between characters, I was like, a functional director could have left all this out. You know, like, let's just stick to the storyline.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't like watching movies where I don't chuckle. No matter how intense the plot is, I want to also be enjoying myself. And it's not that hard.
Whilst we're still staying with the words, Smith type of things.
Yes.
Your other book.
Okay.
The Last Lone Wolf.
Yes.
Recovering the Lost Sacrament of Friendship.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I can tell us more about that then.
Being a lifelong writer, not published writer, but writer at heart, I have, again, 6 projects started. And all of them were meaningful and all of them had depth. and heart and I hoped would impact people. But one day, and this was now probably 6 years ago, I was sitting and saying, what can I offer this glut of information that is very unique to me? What can I offer that is from a perspective most people don't have? And I realized that my lifelong friendship with my best friend, with David, beginning when we were 12 years old, and having that at the center of so much of life's happiness, this is a lost sacrament. This is something, a way, and I define a sacrament as a way that God brings grace into people's lives, brings goodness into people's lives. And friendship is a sacrament that people don't understand. And in our country, my understanding is that at least in Europe, there has always been more of a sense of knowing how to be in it for the long haul, how to have a friend that you build over time. And here we would rather have 1,000 friends that none of them know us deeply. So the shallow relationships are even stronger, I think, in our country. So yeah, I thought, okay, this is something that is at the heart of my life and something that I can write about, not as an expert per se, but at least as more of an expert than many of the topics I'd like to write about. I can write about it from personal experience. You're going to have a hard time getting the kind of reception you're dreaming of, I think, and I have discovered, because people don't have time for friendship at the level I dream of. And so people don't really have time to read a book about friendship. Because if I had said how to get rich quick, everybody would have opened the book because that's something they're interested in.
Yes.
So I developed a lot of the book based on one chapter from C.S. Lewis's book, The Four Loves, where he talks about friendship, about how he believes that, you know, half of the world's happiness has come down through history, has been through this relationship that we now disparage. I know in our country, the marriage, the beautiful golden-haired beauty that is going to solve all of your life's problems when you meet her one day and fall in love and live happily ever after. In our country, that is the myth. That is the prevailing relational myth. Part of that myth is sacrificing, like you reach college and sure, you know, you've had all this fun with the boys, but now it's time to find her. And when you find her, one of the first things you're going to do is throw over your relationships, because of course she has to become everything.
Yes.
And to retrain a generation of guys to say, one of the first things you need to do when you meet her is to say, part of why you like me is because I'm a better person when I'm with the guys. I'm a fuller person. They bring out aspects of my character that I can't get with one person or with you. And so you're not going to want to cut me off from that. You're going to want to understand that this needs to be part of daily, weekly life. I mean, not this battle. I experienced the battle, I know, in college age, the battle of the girlfriend saying, well, of course it's Friday night. You're going to spend it with me, right? And having major pushback on the idea of, well, we thought the guys would go out and do something fun tonight. Well, now, you know, you're an insensitive jerk to your girlfriend because you wanted to be with the boys. My dream would be to reach, not that people our age can't hear the message, but to reach a younger generation to say, before you do this, before you jettison this part of your growing up and say, well, there's no time for this in adult life, I just want you to consider how much richness, how much beauty, you know, you're giving up on when you walk away from your lifelong friendships.
Wow. Oh, you think that book would sell by the bucket load, wouldn't you?
Yes, yes. I don't know. I'm not a salesman. I'm not a type A person.
Taking it further, though, there's a fine line, isn't there, between what you're saying, because something that my wife has always told me, that she wasn't going to change me. She knew that when she married me, it wasn't her modus operandi to change me. Right. Like so many other people, when they get married, think, oh, I'm going to change him or I'm going to change her. So blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
My wife knew that she wasn't to do that. I didn't tell her that.
She just knew.
At all. She just knew. Mm-hmm. But then we have to then balance out with, what's the difference between that and being selfish, whereby you could say, look, love, it's like this. I've got to get out with the lads tonight.
Right.
Yeah. So how do you balance it?
Yeah. Well, I feel like the secular culture in our country, where the guys who they just really have sort of a shallow, have fun approach to life where they could be in major imbalance with this issue. It's like it's Monday night football. I mean, they call it football here, right? Those guys tackling each other with helmets on, but it's called Monday night football, you know, and they're going to go and act like Neanderthals and drink a lot of beer and just yell at the telly. There is that, but I don't feel like men who've been brought up in the church, I don't feel like they're not within sight of that. That's not their danger. They could push so far towards that without being in danger of becoming selfish. I want to respect that, yeah, there are guys who are insensitive and maybe in certain cultures, maybe in inner city cultures especially, there's an insensitivity to what they need to have given up to become married and to become a family man. But my experience, and maybe it's just so much of my personal experience and the people I've known, it's that guys live basically friendless adult lives. And when you interview them, even pastors, especially pastors, you interview them and they say, it would be wonderful, but I have so many responsibilities, so much burden rests on my shoulders to care for this family that there's just not time for that. It's considered a truancy. You know, it would be great. It would be wonderful, but I just can't do it. I guess we're just trying to start with guys who aren't in danger of going too far, guys that aren't going down the selfish route, guys that simply don't understand how much of their personality, how much of their joy in life they have traded in for this idea that friendship is, you know, a juvenile thing or a fraternity thing. It's something that goes away and has to go away in order to make life work. I understand that there could be some pushback from wives who say, I've already got a husband who is out with the guys. He golfs on Mondays, you know, and he's watching, you know, some sport on Tuesdays, and then he's at the pub on Wednesdays. Yeah, I could deal with that. I didn't deal with that in the book because I'm starting from the scratch of guys who don't realize what they've even surrendered in adult life.
So what have they surrendered then?
Well, they've surrendered a place where they are fully known and they can come. You know, Lewis was so good on this in this chapter where he talked about them coming as independent sovereigns. When friends gather, they leave for just a brief evening. They leave the burden of responsibility that they carry and they come so free, so carefree, the ability to meet with peers and talk on a level. I mean, that's the one moment when you can delve into literature and poetry and the things in life that bring you joy, because you don't have to talk about work and you don't have to talk about what's got to be done around the house and spiritual things. There are guys, and God bless them and God bless their wives, there are guys who married somebody who they can share absolutely everything with. And it should be that way. But telling you that it should be that way isn't the same as saying that it is that way. And there are a lot of guys who have a depth of their soul that goes unrevealed for years and years at a time because of a lack of peers, a lack of guys. And the church tries to mimic this. They try to put guys into small groups. They try to bring guys together in a forced setting. And sometimes magic happens, but sometimes it doesn't.
Yes.
Because again, as Lewis said, one of the main things about this is that a man has to feel like these are his guys, that he was free to choose them and that he did choose them, and that they share something. Usually it's history. Usually what they share is a depth of knowing each other. And if you can share this time with somebody who knew you during your carefree days, it's even better. You know, you're in your teens, you're in your 20s, you have life just bursting out of you, dreams, you know, visions for the future. And to be able to sit down with somebody who remembers you from those days, it's so reorienting.
I get where you're coming from now. This is very good. And of course, just to put it on the other side of the fence here, you would be encouraging your wife to do something similar, but with her girlfriends.
Oh, goodness, yes. My argument has always been girls get the need for relationship a little bit more than guys do.
Oh, really?
I think in our current culture, everybody's losing it. I think they have such a relational, as an entire, you know, if you take the male and the female and look at what God did, the relational as a whole is stronger. The force of relational beauty is stronger with them as a whole. Obviously, my wife comes from a situation where she's surrounded by other lonely women, and they all struggle to meet with each other. And when they do, they struggle to go deep. They do. And so I know from anecdotal evidence, my own experiences, that most of the women I know don't have that person that they unburden to on a consistent basis. And this is the thing, we feel like we can go out on a retreat once a year and maybe share some of the angst that we're experiencing. And it's freeing and it's opening and it's a wonderful experience. But the thing is that life comes at you daily.
Yeah.
There's stuff that I need to chat up with my best friend today, because if I wait till tomorrow, there'll be a whole new experience of what's going on. You know, people ask you, how you doing? And somebody will text that you haven't seen in 4 months. How you doing? Well, do I respond for how I'm feeling in the last 30 seconds? Or do I try to get a feel for the last 4 months?
Yeah, it's all one dimensional, isn't it, texting?
Yeah, I've been all over the roller coaster in the last 4 months. Yeah. You know, I lost my dad in February, and I'm going to have a lot of different things to talk about through the months of February and March that I am here in heading into the summer.
Tell us more about that, please. Why you can go outside and do these retreats?
Yeah, well, you know, it runs along the exact same line with the friendship, is that our culture here, certainly in America, and I think all Western culture, is running at a pace that isn't healthy for the human soul. We don't put margin into our activities. Mm-hmm. You know, I notice that in myself. I'm driving from one place to another, and I think, you know, it would probably do me a world of good to pull into this park for 5 minutes and just do nothing but listen to the wind in those trees. And I think, yeah, I'd love to, but then I'm going to be late. I'm going to be late for the next thing on the list. And very few people I know leave that margin. And so they're living in what we call the shallows of their own personality, their own soul. They don't even know what's going on at the level of their own heart, because we've just shut that down. We're just doing what's got to be done. What's got to be done today? We wake up and say, what is on the docket? You know, what's got to be done today? And so we don't think we can stop the whole culture dead in its tracks, but what little can we do? We think guys need to literally escape their entire environment, because if you take 5 minutes at home, you know, if I sit back in my gardens, and they're pretty glorious for American gardens. We've worked really hard.
Monty would be proud of you.
He would be proud. If I go back to sit in them, I'm in that chair for 30 seconds before I see something that needs to be weeded.
Mm.
I'm not in the right headspace to actually just drink it in and just receive the beauty. And so we feel like sometimes we absolutely have to get out of our environment entirely. And so when you combine that with the need to be around peers who you can unburden your soul to, who will listen, that's what they're there for. They don't have an agenda. Most retreats, especially in the church, it's like taking church to the woods is basically all it is. It's like, we're going to do church. We're going to do church the way you all are familiar with it. We're just going to be in the woods.
Mm.
And, you know, we'll be at one of these retreat centers and, you know, walking past the building where they have their gatherings and some other large retreat is going on. And I look at all the guys sitting in this building, listening to somebody give them a speech with PowerPoint going up on the screen, with these windows in the drop back behind them, looking at the Rocky Mountains, unbelievable beauty. We walk past them every time.
Yeah.
And David and I, and we're just like halfway here, and then they don't get it. You know, we're bringing our program out here into the wilderness, and you don't need it out here. So to go out unscripted is what we do. You know, it's like we're doing two things. We're getting you out of your environment. We're putting you in an environment where beauty can heal from all of the noise and abrasiveness of the world. And I guess it's three things. And we're opening ourselves up to listen. And you basically are like, so what's going on?
Yeah.
Tell me your story. Tell me the story of the last 6 months or the last year. And you don't get a lot accomplished that way, because you find out people can talk for hours when it's about themselves. They have a lot to share.
Yeah, yeah.
And you realize. And then, you know, I always ask them, I always say, okay, so who is it on a daily? All right, let's not go daily. Who is it on a weekly basis? Who is it on a consistent basis that you tell all this? You know, who do you dump on? And they'll look at you. They'll think. Sometimes they don't even have to think. But 99 times out of 100, they come back and they say, I don't have anybody like that.
Yeah.
And that's what breaks my heart. And that's what makes me think, what I look back and I say, if I hadn't, you know, known David since I was 12 years old, you know, how different would my life be? I take it for granted. I take for granted that if I need to talk to somebody, and he lives in Denver. I mean, Denver is, you know, a 17-hour drive from Detroit, but we can talk every single day. I just wish everybody had that. And unlike most ministries where you're trying to come up with a plan where you can now minister to 10,000 people, because then you feel like you're really changing the world. I realize that we're saying to people, look, what we want you to do is something I can't really do for you. I can't be that best friend that you need. I can only show you the picture of what it looks like and say, you know, you've already got that guy. I'm sure you do. You know, maybe it's just somebody from the pub. But you can build that sort of relationship. And if you take the risk, I think you'll find that that guy is just as hungry as you are to have somebody who knows them inside and out.
Yeah. When you take out to the woods, to the Rockies, yeah, wherever you go,
yeah,
the group that goes with you, mm-hmm, where do all these people come from?
Well, you know, the first people I invite are our own peers. You know, I send a message out. There's probably 15, 20 guys that I start with that I say, hey, this is when we're going. And we're giving you the first pick, because honestly, in order to model this correctly, I mean, I want to be with my guys. I want to be with guys that I already have some history with, and they're not nearly as deep as my best friend. That's not that sort of a history.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're guys that I'm not starting from scratch with. You know, they're guys that we did something together 10 years ago. You know, we've stayed in contact. We have a few laughs from the past. Buddies from college, from university, from, you know, some mission trip, that sort of thing. But then from there, obviously, everybody's so busy, you end up not getting the guys that you would have handpicked if you could handpick. And so then from there, you just sort of throw it out there. And, you know, we have a website. Our website doesn't necessarily get the kind of hits we wish it did. We're not getting overwhelmed with guys from, you know, all over the country saying, gosh, this sounds awesome. I want to do this. It's a challenge. It always helps if you have a connection with a church, because it seems like if you have somebody in ministry that gives some legitimacy to what you're doing. And I hate that. I hate that you need legitimacy, that you can't just have guys stumble across it. And that sometimes those are arguments God and I have, you know, with, I know your Holy Spirit can just nudge absolute random strangers,
yeah,
with the name of my website. I know you can do that. I've seen you do it in other people's lives. You know, here's the challenge, right? Everybody who's ever tried to make $1 million has the same challenge. Got a great idea. I know the need is there. How do I connect the great idea with the need? How do I get in front of the people that need to hear this?
Yes.
How do I get to the guys? And that's where not being a type A driven person and not being a marketer is a real challenge. It's like David and I laugh about it. You know, it's like, we'd love to have a type A person on our team. We'd probably dislike them personally. We'd probably have nothing in common. It'd be hard to go out for lunch and have anything to talk about, but gosh, would they help us? Yeah, because yeah, they could see the problems that we feel are insurmountable short of supernatural intervention. You know, they could see and say, well, no, this is a very practical way to connect you with your audience.
See, what you're saying here, I think is fantastic and a bit of a challenge to those listening today who are thinking, well, yeah, maybe I don't have that best friend. You know, I've got loads of outer circle friends or even middle circle friends, but no, mm-hmm, inner circle friends.
Yeah.
And yet you could most probably say, when I contact four or five of these outer circle friends, I say, let's just go away for the weekend.
Yes.
It'd be very easy in my case, because, you know, I've been so immersed in rock music and football especially.
Yeah.
I could say to some friends, you know, if it was possible, come on, let's go away for the weekend. We'll go and watch Bristol City.
Yeah.
Well, the problem with doing that is that whilst it'd be great to go and watch Bristol City play wherever,
yeah,
you'd be so immersed in thinking how the team's going to play. Then you watch the game. Then afterwards, you talk about how bad they were, or maybe for a change, they were actually very good.
Yeah.
That you're actually missing a point. So it'd have right. to, you'd have to choose a venue whereby it's got nothing to do with what you really like so that you can just open up. Would I be right saying that's the best way to do it?
It is probably the best way to do it. Yeah, I think, gosh, that's hard because your picture of going to see the game with the guys is so enticing to me. I just want to say, do it, do it.
Oh, we do. Don't worry.
Yeah, that more than obviously has to do with this. And this is the hard thing, that idea of being intentional, right? Because you can let any event flow naturally and stay on the surface. And being intentional is the hard part, is that moment where amidst all the frivolity, you're able to say, you know, really, how you doing?
Yeah.
You know, I know you had a hard time with your son with such and such. And but that aside, yeah, again, I don't know if this is popular anymore because obviously everybody has vehicles now, but C.S. Lewis and his buddies, they did walking tours. And I feel like that's a very English thing, is a walking tour. And maybe it's not. Maybe it's a 1920s, 1930s thing and doesn't exist anymore. But I read of his tours where they would pull out a map. They didn't have a GPS. They had a good old paper map, I'm sure. And one of their buddies would drop them off at a particular point, and they'd start hiking, you know, through the Cotswolds or something, with a bit of a vision of a small town that they were going to stop at. And
yeah.
And the pub they were going to have lunch at. What do you do for 3 hours of a hike? Well, you kind of have to talk, right? You know?
Yes.
So yeah, being wise. And I think that's what you're saying is, well, you've been to that football match enough to know how it's going to go. So being wise about which situations lend themselves towards conversation and which ones don't. We go into the wilderness and it's a retreat. Like I said, there's not like there's teaching sessions, but it's very intention that we serve the guys breakfast and then say, okay, you know, the next hour and a half, we really just want you to go take a walk by yourself. I don't know what your relationship with God looks like. I don't know if an hour and a half is going to kill you or if an hour and a half is going to fly by, but we just want you to go. You can take a good book with you if you want. You can take your journal. You can take your Bible if you need some props. For that time, you can take them. We make sure that we're putting them in a setting where it's easier to hear the voice of God. And the noisier a place is, the harder it is to hear.
Yes.
So nature lends itself for sure. I mean, I would love to take guys on pilgrimages to bring them over to where you are. Then there'd be a lot of noise, but it would have to be a real intentional, like, you know, we're going to see some sites that have to do with St. Patrick. You know, we're going to see where Lewis taught. We're going to experience, you know, 1,000 years of Christianity instead of the 30 years that we all seem to know about in our culture.
Well, do you know what? You've nailed it there, because a podcast that we did for St. Patrick's Day 2 years ago that we then repeated a few months ago on St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
It's all based around a place called Downpatrick.
Okay.
And we've done a mini walking tour, so you can actually go to it. You can listen to the episodes. We take you up the hill. We take you here, take you there.
Oh, that's beautiful.
It is a phenomenal place.
Wow.
Absolutely phenomenal. So there you go.
Yeah.
You can bring your guys over.
Okay. We'll put that on.
And try it.
Yeah.
Yeah, please, please. If people are listening and want to know more, have a listen to the episode about St. Patrick. You're right. Walking along there, it does break the barriers. And this year, a friend of mine paid for me to fly over because he knows the situation I'm in.
Okay.
We spent about an hour in the pub before the Bristol City match. And it was great because he knows about my life. He knows me very, very well indeed. It just broke down so many barriers that we were able to sit down in a quiet pub. And he was just able to explain to me what he thought was going on and how he could help in a way of just giving some ideas to me. And that's the kind of friendship you need, surely.
Absolutely. So individualism is something that we don't even realize how deeply ingrained it is in us. And I had a few moments in writing the book, talk about embarrassing moments, where I had to stop and say, I just wrote about myself like in the most negative light possible. I had no idea that this was true of me until I put the words on the page. But I do. In the spiritual realm, I have the sense that I've got enough problems and you've got your problems. And God bless you, if you bring them to me, maybe I will interact a little bit. But in general, I don't take any responsibility for your problems. Like, I've got mine, you've got yours. To break out of that into more of a, I mean, and you can't do this without picturing the four hobbits of the Lord of the Rings, but to break out of that into this place that says, your problems are my problems. Like, I know you're going through something, and it would be a lot easier to just sort of put my head down and look the other way, as opposed to actually digging into it. Like, sometimes maybe even an uncomfortable way to come in and say, I am not going to let you go through this alone. I just realized how often I avoid going there in the first place. I have such a compassionate personality and such a desire to help that once I'm in it, then I'm involved and very empathetic and very good. But I found how many times I just want to say, yeah, I see that person is backsliding in that area. Well, that's between them and God. It's so much easier to say, you know, it's not my responsibility.
Yeah, you don't want to own their problem. That's the thing. Because if you do, you then take off all their burdens for all the wrong reasons. You don't want that to happen, do you?
Yeah, right. So, and I know I've got a lot of problems. But when I stopped to think about it and I thought, do I want all my closest friends leaving all my problems to me? Or would I just die to have some of them say, hey, we're going to do this together? I realized, my goodness, I would absolutely love for other people to say, I have a vested interest in what you're struggling with. I really do. One of my chapters in the book and what I took from the four hobbits heading off in the Fellowship of the Ring was the concept of jumping down a dragon's throat. And Merry and Pippin say, well, we know Sam would jump down a dragon's throat for you. It just clicked with me that I'm looking, my definition of friendship is something where you don't have to calculate what it's going to cost you. It's instinctive. You've reached that level of understanding with each other that if you needed something, I would do it. And it might even cost me something more than I would normally pay to anyone else. But for you, it's without thought. The sacrifice, it's a joy to do it. And we don't even think of we don't even speak of sacrifice because, you know, men don't do that. We do it. We don't even have to speak of it. It's just an understood. It's just so beautiful.
I think what this podcast is actually going to do is more as if we're throwing stones into lakes to see the ripples. And it's going to challenge people to say, I could do that. I can do that. I need to go away, talk to some people. Mm-hmm. But if they want to come to you and talk to you, how can they get hold of you?
Our best way of contact is our website, which is www.thewarriorspath.org. It's a very image-rich website. It's encouraging. It's got links to the book I have written on friendship. It's definitely got our contact information. We are ready to do more than we've been doing. And that's the short of it. And maybe you're exactly the same way. You feel like, I've got energy, I've got passion, and we just need to be connected with people that need us. We're there to serve, to teach, to encourage, anything that we can do. That is the nice part about such an open-ended ministry. It's a good thing to have a vision, but it's also good to be like, we want to be useful. We want to be useful.
I hear that. Well, Derek, it's great what you've shared. Derek Still, who is your Christian hero, please?
I hate to be as obvious as everybody else you've ever interviewed, but the first thing that sprang to mind absolutely had to be St. Francis of Assisi.
Really?
Yeah.
Go for it. Because?
Again, because I'm an Anglophile, I will blame G.K. Chesterton for the phenomenal little book he wrote about St. Francis, because it captured my heart for sure, my romance. There's so many quotes that I daily or weekly take from that. Chesterton said, for St. Francis, Christianity was not a thing like a religion. It was a thing like a love affair. And that sort of is what separates me from a vast majority of at least the foolishness that I see going on in the church, is that, I want to be as foolish as St. Francis was, because he acted like a man who was madly in love. That's why he could fast and sing, and not fast out of somberness, but it was a heart thing for him. And then obviously how he chose to live is phenomenal. And I'm sure there's many, many other people who have chosen it, and history just happened to paint him at the right time and in the right way to be in history. I mean, so many people do great things and nobody ever knows what they've done, but we have such a wealth of stories coming down from the things he did and the kind of person he was.
Yeah.
The little brothers of Jesus. It's just such a beautiful idea.
Well, it's a great choice. Derek Steele, thank you so much for joining us today. I think you've given us more questions to think upon than answers. That's got to be a good thing.
Oh, thank you, Martin. I absolutely loved it. Really appreciate being on your show.
Brilliant. I'll send you the invoice.
Okay. What kind of currency do you take over there?
Oh, anything.
Tickets to your favorite team, huh?
Oh, that'd be brilliant.
Would you have let me go on the show if you knew I was a gooner? Probably not.
Derek Steele, thank you for joining us today. God bless. Next time on Off-Grid Christianity.
For most of that patch, that longer patch of, you know, several years, it wasn't that I didn't believe in him. I just wasn't sure if I liked him because of some of what had been so difficult about life at that point. And there was something as well about, I felt like I knew all the right answers, even to some of the, you know, difficult theological questions about how good God allows suffering and things like that. I felt like I knew all the right answers, but they didn't hold water for me.
Mm. So please join me in the next episode of Off-Grid Christianity with special guest Kath Butler. Cheerio.